Pakistani parliament and cabinet are dissolved shortly after a no-confidence motion against Prime Minister Imran Khan is blocked. Russia says it's launched a missile attack on an oil refinery and several fuel storage facilities in Ukraine's strategic port of Odessa. A two-month truce takes effect in Yemen. The Ansar movement says it's committed to the ceasefire as long as the other party does the same. I'm Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Now, beginning this news hour with the latest about the political drama unfolding in Pakistan. Hours ago, the parliament rejected a no-confidence motion tabled by the opposition to oust Prime Minister Imran Khan. Deputy Parliament Speaker blocked the motion, calling it unconstitutional. President Arif Alvi has dissolved the National Assembly upon a request by the Prime Minister. Imran Khan's cabinet has also been dissolved in anticipation of fresh elections. Now, reacting to this, the joint opposition says that they will petition the Supreme Court to rule against the blocking the no-confidence move. The opposition blames Imran Khan for failing to revive the economy and crack down on corruption. But Khan says that the United States has been orchestrating efforts to topple him. Time now for the news review section. Tensions running high in the occupied West Bank amid Israel's violent raids and deadly shootings in Palestinian villages and towns. Palestinians, mostly youth, hit the streets chanting anti-Israel slogans. Ten Palestinians have been killed and dozens more arrested in a crackdown that began earlier this week. The Palestinian Authority has strongly condemned the killings and stressed the call on the international community to provide protection for the Palestinians. Resistance groups, the Islamic Jihad and Hamas, issued strong warnings to Tel Aviv after its forces opened fire on a vehicle, leaving three Palestinians dead in the early hours of Saturday. Hamas described the killings as a cowardly assassination and said that the regime cannot guarantee its security by killing Palestinians. Islamic Jihad identified the victims as its members and said that such atrocious acts will not go unpunished. Now, allow me to invite two guests and ask them their opinion about this and discuss that a bit. So, Rodney Shakespeare, academic and commentator, is joining us from London. Also with us will be Mick Napier, activist and commentator from Edinburgh. Now, Professor Shakespeare, more and more Palestinian special youths are losing their lives in this recent violence. What do you think has been responsible for this recent escalation?
Behind the situation is a fundamental contradiction. The Israeli entity is expanding into the lands of others, other populations. And when it does that and it doesn't give democratic rights, you have the fundamental contradiction. If it's a democracy, it would, and to maintain the facade of democracy, it would need to expel the populations or kill them. And that is why essentially what you have at the moment, they're in the stage of suppressing the populations and not giving rights. Because they're not a democracy. I mean, the West can't have it all the way around in all respects. Israel is an autocratic, repressive, apartheid entity. And it has nothing to do with what might be called traditional Western values, if they exist. So hypocrisy on a large scale is the nature of Western support for the actions of Israel, which all the time end up with these brutal and unnecessary killings.
Okay. Now, Mick, some people we've been talking to, they blame the Palestinian Authority for part of this, and they kind of believe that they're also their security coordination and collaboration with the Israelis is partly responsible for this. Let's have your opinion on that.
Well, of course, and security cooperation with, as your other guest said, a colonial and a colonizing power whose stated intention is to remove all the native people that it possibly can and replace them with Zionist Jews from around the world. In that situation, what can one cooperate on? The reality is that the Israelis don't offer the Palestinians, and they don't offer the PA even, anything remotely resembling a neo-colonial solution where they would have clients who would remain in control as long as they accepted their subordinate status. The specific thing about the Zionist project is they wish to remove all the natives, and that would include the personnel in the PA, no less than the taxi drivers or farmers. So the reality is that it has to be carried out by tremendous violence. As Jabotinsky, one of the founders of Zionism, said, no colonizing power has ever carried out its task by soft language and sweet music or whatever. It has to be a very violent project, and colonization around the world has always been like that. Look, if we're talking about the killings of these three Palestinians or the other Palestinians in the same time frame, occasionally the Israelis make a mistake. They kill British citizens, or they kill a child, and the whole thing is recorded and played on Israeli radio. When that happens, you get trials. And the Israelis always say that the soldiers weren't killed, sorry, the Palestinians were not killed by Israeli soldiers. They put up a whole facade of lies, which in the unusual situation of a trial where there's some very formidable British family or some other group who can cross it, the lies fall away. And we find that people are executed in cold blood. A British man, Tom Herndahl, is executed trying to protect school children from an Israeli sniper. And you might well ask, why does anybody have to protect school children from Israeli snipers? So we find that the practice is one of straightforward killing of individuals. The Israeli army has an open practice called confirming the kill, which means that if someone's wounded, they approach the wounded person and execute them lying on the ground, children included. We have testimonies not just from Palestinians as to the atrocities that are committed, but also from Israelis. There's a group of Israeli soldiers who, to save their own soul, tell people what they have been doing in the occupied territory. And it's absolutely shocking. I mean, how degenerate can you be? When Palestinians approach a checkpoint, one of the Israeli soldiers' games that they have explained, made public, is to pick on a Palestinian, wrestle him to the ground, strangle him into unconsciousness, and the soldier whose Palestinian takes the longest to be unconscious is the winner of that grisly game. I'm not making this up. It's Israeli soldiers' testimony of what happens. An Israeli, a pro-Israel delegation of senior lawyers left from London a few years ago to visit the West Bank, and they came back horrified. They said there's no justice system. It's a law situation. Settlers and soldiers cooperated to abuse and beat and so on. So there's no defense for what Israel does. It can only be that in order for the Palestinians to win their freedom, they need massive support from around the world. Because if I could just make a final point, in every anti-colonial struggle, Algeria, Vietnam, Aden and so on, South Yemen, the balance of power has never been so overwhelming against the native people as it is in Palestine, and thus the need for very concrete, practical solidarity, such as dockers in California turning away every Israeli ship from Auckland Port, or us here in Edinburgh making sure the biggest arts festival in the world is a no-go area for Israeli participation. We need that kind of solidarity. The people who are occupying arms factories across England, defying the authorities, going to court and winning because popular opinion is very sympathetic. So it's a brutal price the Palestinians are paying under this occupation, but the Israelis are already, in the court of world opinion, a pariah state, a polecat state.
Okay, and that then we come to the end of this newsroom. Let me thank our guests. We had Rodney Shakespeare, academic and commentator from London, and Mick Napier, activist and commentator from Edinburgh. Okay, now turning to the conflict in Ukraine, where Russian airstrikes have rocked the strategic port city of Odessa. The blast sent up columns of black smoke with flames visible in the industrial area. Russian defense minister says that the attacks destroyed an oil refinery and three fuel storage facilities that Ukraine used to supply its troops. Russian forces appear to be withdrawing from Ukraine's north, but Kiev's warning that Moscow is consolidating and preparing powerful raids in the south. And that echoes a course of Western assessments that Russian troops are regrouping. Odessa, a historical city of around 1 million people, is Ukraine's largest black seaport. Russia's military operation in Ukraine and the West's response by imposing a barrage of sanctions against Moscow have renewed the debate whether such punitive measures result in the desired outcome. Voices from Washington's political establishment are warning about the dire consequences of waging an economic war against Moscow. They're also questioning the legality of the U.S. involvement in the conflict.
Over a month ago, Russian President Vladimir Putin announced what he called a special military operation to, quote, demilitarize and denazify Ukraine. The West, which had been warning Russia against such a move, resorted to providing aid to Kiev and decided not to join the war. It, however, used a different type of warfare, the economic one.
We're coming together to reduce Europe's dependence on Russian energy. Putin has issued Russia's energy resources to coerce and manipulate its neighbors. That's how he's used it. He's used the profits to drive his war machine. And that's why earlier this month I announced the United States would ban all imports of Russian energy.
The United States and its allies imposed several rounds of sanctions on Russia, mainly targeting its energy and banking sectors. The decision is drawing criticism, including from among U.S. lawmakers. Thomas Massey, a Republican representative for Kentucky in the U.S. House, says no treaty can supersede the U.S. Congress in determining when America should go to war. He explains that the often-cited Article 5 of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, which states that an attack on one member state will be met with a collective response, isn't binding. That's because Article 11 of the same treaty stipulates that the provisions of the pact must be carried out according to the constitutions of the respective member states.
The United States is putting its country and its citizens in a psychological and economic war against Russia. It's a war against Russia in every sense but a direct military conflict. And there's a very thin line, and we're very near crossing that line to direct military conflict. So what this guy is saying is a correct warning to the American people. We cannot let ourselves be pushed into war by default and by some kind of automatic mechanism that sidesteps what would be the constitutional and legal and political requirements that if we're going to go to war with a country, we have to have a congressional resolution for it.
Besides, as several officials and experts have been warning, cutting off a major country from the global supply chain will expose the whole world to risks that could snowball into a catastrophe of epic proportions.
Yemen says it's committed to a UN-brokered ceasefire with the Saudi-led coalition as long as the other side adheres to it. Army spokesman Yahya Saria made the announcement in a Twitter post. According to the United Nations Special Envoy for Yemen, the two-month truce began at 1600 GMT. All offensive military operations, including ground, aerial, and navy attacks by the two sides, will be stopped under the ceasefire deal.
As Yemenis are marking the holy month of Ramadan, a new truce was announced by the United Nations Special Envoy for Yemen to help the humanitarian situation in the country. The parties agreed to a nationwide ceasefire for 2 months, in addition to suspending all sorts of aerial attacks from both parties.
The international community has become convinced that this unjustified and barbaric aggression against the Yemeni people must be stopped, and the violations and crimes left by the war are a disgrace to the international community. There are indications of the continuation of the truce, and we hope that it will be the beginning of a complete end to the war and the lifting of the siege on Yemen so that we can confront the humanitarian crisis.
The agreement includes opening Sana'a Airport for two flights a week from and to Egypt and Jordan only, and allowing Yemen's fuel ships to arrive at Hudaydah Port. However, observers say this agreement is the result of the recent attacks of Yemen's armed forces against Aramco facilities across Saudi Arabia.
I think, of course, this latest attack against Saudi Arabia and as well in the last few months against United Arab Emirates, it has forced Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates to accept this truce. But it will be really clear in the coming days and week, will they accept this and will they, because there have been many like agreement that has been signed as an example in Stockholm. But still at that time, because Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates were not part of this agreement, they have not signed and they were not mentioned in any of those agreements. That's why they have actually not respecting them.
In addition to the war, Saudi Arabia has been tightening the all-out blockade it imposes on Yemen and has prevented Yemen's fuel ships to enter the country. This has worsened the situation in war-torn Yemen, which is already going through the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the UN.
Despite the tragic humanitarian situation of their country, Yemenis say there has always been light despite all the darkness. They believe the UN brokered agreement may lead to a comprehensive political solution as the Saudi war must come to an end. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
And that's a wrap for this broadcast from Tehran. Thank you for being with us.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei's opinion on the blessed month of Ramadan. What is the main philosophy of fasting in the month of Ramadan? June 14, 2016. Our responsibility is to work hard to avoid sins and, to put it briefly, to show piety. Piety which has been considered as the main philosophy and goal of fasting in the month of Ramadan means this. Piety means taking care of oneself. We should constantly take care of ourselves. Of course, primarily I'm addressing this statement to myself. All of us are responsible. Therefore, we should appreciate the value of the month of Ramadan. We should appreciate the value of this month of Ramadan, which we are in now. Thousands of thousand months of Ramadan have come and gone throughout history. And thousands of thousand months of Ramadan will come and go, during which time we are not living. Amid this billion months of Ramadan in history, we are present in a few of them. In this chain of the months of Ramadan of history, we have been given the opportunity to spend 20, 30, 50, or 60 months of Ramadan from the age of taklif until the end of our lives. So we should appreciate the value of them.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
month of Ramadan draws people's attention to life after death. June 23rd, 2015. One issue that is repeated in the prayers of the auspicious month of Ramadan is drawing people's attention to the worlds after this material world, the world of death, the world of the judgment day, and one's difficulties in facing divine calculations and divine questioning. This is one of the issues that exist in the prayers of the auspicious month of Ramadan. Paying attention to this is very important for us officials who have certain responsibilities. A factor that helps us control and monitor this is attention to these worlds. When we understand that not the weight of an atom becomes absent from him, in Holy Quran, chapter 34, verse 3, that no small move, action, and statement will escape the eyes of divine calculators after our death, and that we will be questioned about all these things. This will deeply affect our behavior, our statements, and our moves.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
A fresh round of violence by the Israeli military has erupted in the occupied West Bank. Israeli forces raided Jenin refugee camp, killing two Palestinians and wounding 15 others. The army stated that its forces stormed the camp to arrest suspects in connection to Tuesday night's operation in Beni Brak, one of Tel Aviv suburbs, which led to the killing of five Israelis and the perpetrator Diyah Hamashi from Ya'bet town near Jenin. During the funeral procession of the two youths in Jenin, mourners vowed to avenge their killing, saying the operation was meant to satisfy the angry settlers.
Israeli forces raided Jenin's refugee camp and the city with large numbers of armored vehicles to kill people in cold blood and to commit more crimes just to satisfy the settlers. It's a criminal regime with its military.
Following Jenin's raid, Israel declared a military operation, dubbed Wave Breaker, to stem what it described as a rising tide of terrorism by Palestinians. In 1 week, Tel Aviv was shocked by three lethal series of operations in lands occupied since 1948, leaving 11 Israelis dead.
The current Zionist regime doesn't want an escalation to keep its internal status, despite a call for Israelis to carry arms. At the same time, it gives the settlers free hand along with the military practices.
A third Palestinian man was also shot dead after claims he stabbed and injured an Israeli man with a screwdriver on a bus near the illegal settlement of Efrat and Gush Atzion settlement block between Bethlehem and El Khalil. The Israelis are calling for a military campaign in the occupied West Bank, demanding a painful response. On the other hand, Palestinian resistance groups have vowed to respond to Israeli crimes, saying they have their hand on the trigger. Mona Qandil, occupied Ramallah.
Okay.
In France, the suburbs around cities are known for being poor, immigrant, often Muslim, and for voting for the left. But a new poll shows that the far right has surged in popularity. At 42% of voter intentions, the far right has become as popular as the three centrist parties combined. It's now only the poorest areas of the suburbs where the stereotype of the so-called red suburb still holds. Overall, 60% of the suburbs are planning to vote for the two political extremes, in a major rejection of the two mainstream parties and President Emmanuel Macron's new party.
These areas feel abandoned by the city centers and the political elite there. So their turn to the political extremes is actually a protest vote. They have a desire to try a different type of politics because they feel that in recent decades, things have only gotten worse for themselves and for France. After decades of alternating power, the mainstream parties are not coming back.
In 2017, the National Front's Marine Le Pen lost in a 66-34% landslide. However, the latest polls show a 53-47% race, which is now within the margin for error. Many Muslims say they are ready to do what was once unthinkable, vote for the far right. Analysts say that suburbs are now voting similar to rural areas and for similar reasons.
10 years ago, people may have voted based on identity issues, but this election is all about class. What we hear voters talking about is inflation, the loss of public services, and unemployment. Mainstream parties don't have a good record on these issues, which have been ignored in this campaign, making these voters even angrier.
The national turn to the right is based on pocketbook issues, but people may also have been persuaded by what's been on the nightly news all year long. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
In his 50-minute televised address on Thursday, Pakistan's embattled Prime Minister Imran Khan came up with serious allegations against the U.S.
They say they're angry with Pakistan. They make this excuse. They say they will forgive Pakistan if Imran Khan loses in the no-trust move. But if the move fails, Pakistan will have to go through a difficult time.
The so-called threat letter was based on the conversation between the Pakistani ambassador in Washington and the U.S. officials. According to the government, U.S. officials were unhappy with Pakistan over its neutral stance on the Russia-Ukraine crisis. The letter then goes on to say that Pakistan would be isolated if the vote of no confidence against Imran Khan failed. This has led the government to conclude that the no-trust move of opposition has the backing of the U.S. Pakistan has summoned a senior diplomat in Islamabad and lodged a formal protest over the controversy.
It's a serious thing, very serious, that pertains to Pakistan's national security. And the onus lies on the Prime Minister Imran Khan that he should bring forth, tell the nation, tell the stakeholders that what is the conspiracy.
Opposition parties have strongly rejected allegations that the U.S. was behind their no-confidence motion. The government also says it has uncovered a plot to assassinate Prime Minister Khan. All this is happening just ahead of the crucial vote of no confidence against the Prime Minister on Sunday.
Prime Minister Khan is linking the vote of no confidence with a foreign conspiracy. Despite losing a majority in the parliament, the embattled Prime Minister insists he would not step down. This means the political battle would go all down to the wire. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
As the conflict in Ukraine grinds on, almost 7 million are displaced inside the country and about 4 million people have left their homes in search of shelter abroad. These numbers are increasing on a daily basis. So far, almost 80,000 Ukrainians have arrived in Italy, the majority of whom are women and children, with the most popular destinations being big cities like Milan, Rome and Naples. At the beginning of the war, about 3,000 people were arriving in Italy from Ukraine every day, but now the numbers seem to have slowed. On Thursday, Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi praised the UN for its contribution to the handling of the refugee crisis.
The UN has been very active in designing humanitarian programs for Ukraine refugees. Bear in mind that while Poland and Romania have received millions of Ukrainians, almost 80,000 refugees have reached Italy so far, and about 300,000 have landed in Germany.
Amid the wave of support provided to Ukrainian refugees, aid groups operating in conflict-stricken areas have warned that non-Ukrainians who are trying to flee from Ukraine are facing a number of additional challenges, including legal exclusion from certain forms of help and racial discrimination. Over 2 million refugees, more than half of the 4 million who have fled the conflict so far, have crossed from Ukraine into Poland. According to figures from the Polish border guards, around 4% are not Ukrainian nationals and include significant numbers of African and Asian students. Reports have emerged that many non-Ukrainians have been subjected to racist and unfair treatment at the border with Poland.
This is unlawful. Everyone has the right to leave Ukraine under these circumstances. Ukrainians, with exception of male Ukrainians who are under military rule, but all foreigners in Ukraine, of course, have to be admitted to the neighboring country, Poland, Hungary or other countries.
Members of the bloc, including Italy, have ratified a 2001 EU directive which grants temporary protection in the event of a mass influx of displaced persons. However, non-Ukrainians have been excluded from the temporary protection scheme.
In this directive, it is foreseen that only those who are directly concerned with a country in crisis are entitled for temporary protection, citizens of that country, and refugees recognized previously in that country, and that other citizens is up to the member states to determine if they would benefit from the temporary protection.
So far, 17 billion euros have been allocated from the EU for Ukrainian refugee reception. However, uncertainty remains around quotas and relocations. Max Civili, Rome.
An Iranian parliamentary delegation arrived in Syria, headed by Deputy Parliament Speaker Ali Nikzad. He met with Speaker of Syria's People's Assembly, Hamoudeh Sabbagh, hailing the distinguished relations between the Syrian and Iranian parliaments. Sabbagh expressed appreciation to Iran's steadfast and principled stances in support of Syria, especially in its war on terror.
The Iranian government and parliament were and remain standing beside Syria and President Assad. We in the parliament will ratify any draft resolution with regards to cooperation with Syria. We will give all permissions to the Iranian government to cooperate with Syria and help developing it.
The top legislator also met Syria's Foreign Minister Faisal al-Miqdad, who called for enhancing economic relations for the benefit of the two nations, condemning unilateral sanctions by the U.S. and its Western allies on Syria and Iran. Nikzad expressed Iran's willingness to increase the bulk of trade exchange and economic partnerships with Syria.
Strategic relations with Syria will never break. Iran will continue to support Syria in the reconstruction phase. We reject the U.S. unilateral economic sanctions on Syria, and Iran will spare no effort in assisting Syria in the fuel, economic, and trade sectors.
The Iranian lawmaker also held a meeting with Syria's Prime Minister Hussein Arnous. Both officials underlined the importance of removing any obstacle in the face of implementing agreements signed between both states, as well as increasing the number of joint investment projects. The visit comes as a reiteration of the brotherly relations, not just between governments, but also the peoples of the two countries. The exchange of officials' visits between Syria and Iran recently increased with the aim of boosting economic cooperation. Muhammad Ali, Damascus.
The Saudi siege, a war crime and a genocide, is the title of the seventh official report published by Yemen's Ministry of Human Rights in the capital Sana'a. The report highlights the impact of the Saudi blockade on the humanitarian situation in Yemen.
Mr. Abdul Malik al-Houthi was clear in his speech when he said that we will not stand idly by and we will not allow this siege to come to Saudi Arabia and its allies, that we will use our right to respond. Any country has to protect its citizens. Therefore, I believe that the coming days are fraught with surprises. Saudi Arabia has maintained an all-out blockade on Yemen and prevents the entry of food, medicine, and fuel, and this is genocide.
Officials say the Saudi-led coalition has committed thousands of war crimes against Yemeni women and children during 7 years of war. They also say Riyadh's breach of international law is covered up politically by the United Nations.
We've entered the 8th year. The Saudi-led coalition is still committing war crimes against Yemenis, especially the siege, which takes more lives than airstrikes. Public services, especially the health sector, have been greatly affected by the lack of fuel, and this threatens the lives of thousands of patients. Unfortunately, the United Nations provides the political cover-up for the illegal acts of Saudi Arabia.
Saudi Arabia, backed by Washington, launched a deadly war on Yemen in March 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, including women and children. The United Nations describes war-torn Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, but has taken no action to end this humanitarian catastrophe.
Observers say Saudi Arabia is still committing war crimes as it refuses to lift the siege on the country, depriving millions of Yemenis of food and medicine and causing more lives, especially for patients, amid the collapse of the health sector and the continued closure of Sana'a Airport. Abdulatif Loshali, Sana'a.
For 8 years, Donbas, a region of eastern Ukraine that did not accept the results of the Kyiv coup in 2014, has been under frequent shelling from national battalions and the armed forces of Ukraine. Residents of Donbas called it a war crime against the people, and from that moment Ukraine ceased to be a state in their eyes. According to Russian investigators, the actions of the Ukrainian military led to the deaths of more than 2,600 civilians, while more than 5,500 people were injured. 2,200 civilian infrastructure facilities were destroyed.
This is a town, a school number 50 of the sadly known town of Gorlovka in the Donbas region, which is being shelled regularly.
The last time it was shelled by Ukrainian artillery on 24th of February, the teachers died on the spot. But one of the heaviest recent shellings, hushed up by the Western media, happened on March 14 in Donetsk. The Ukrainian military hit the center of the city with a Tochka-U tactical missile equipped with a cluster warhead. The rocket was shot down, but due to the fall of debris, 23 people died and 18 were injured.
The special operation of Russia is our opportunity to defend ourselves, the possibility that the Donbas will not be destroyed and hundreds of thousands of civilians will not be lost due to the Ukrainian aggression. We will be able to remain ourselves. We will be able to speak Russian, our native language, with which we were born and studied. We will have the right to relate to the history and results of the great patriotic war without manipulation. Our grandfathers and great-grandfathers can be considered the winners against fascism and in no other way. Thanks to Russia's special operation, joy and hope for a just future appeared in the Donbas.
The ultimate goal of our republic is to hold a referendum in which the people exercise their constitutional right and express their opinion on joining the Russian Federation. I'm sure that's exactly what will happen. The vast majority of the inhabitants of the Luhansk Republic have been living for 8 years under constant shelling and being in an economic and political blockade, experiencing the mockery and horrors of the Nazi battalions of Ukraine. They felt support only from the Russian Federation. With hope and a dream in our hearts, we are waiting for the opportunity to become part of the Russian Federation, to return, as they said in the Crimea, to our native harbour and start working on a great future.
The emotional answer of the head of the LPR to Press TV about holding a referendum on joining Russia caused a wide response. Later he explained that the main task facing the leadership of the LPR now is the completion of hostilities. According to him, the battalions of Ukrainian nationalists are responsible for the murder, torture, robbery and rape of civilians in Donbas. Most of them are relied on the experience of the commanders of the SS division during the World War II, and here in the settlement of Trehizbionka, still terrified, people did not believe in liberation and whispered about how they were bullied and subjected to violence. Here, the LPR servicemen found torture chambers with Nazi symbols hung up and the remains of those who simply disappeared from the village one day without a trace. The documents and an armaments depot were left by terrorist organization Right Sector. The LDPR military and people's militia say they collected documents about cases of cruelty against the population of Donbas and people from other regions of Ukraine. The documents include photos of people killed by bombing, runic symbols and signs of national battalions, facts of war crimes against humanity, and the positions of battalions in settlements with caches of weapons of mass destruction. Numerous residents of the recently liberated Volnovakha told Press TV that when the Russian forces entered their town, Ukrainian battalions left all the civilian property destroyed. Residents of the city were forbidden to evacuate, and looting had begun.
I am the chief physician of the Volnovakha District Hospital. This is what is left. This is our outpatient polyclinic building. We were in the basements. We all worked and provided assistance to the victims. Our employee died during a shelling from the Ukrainian side. Only on March 13, we were able to get out. There were heavy weapons of the Ukrainian forces on the territory of our hospital. All international conventions prohibit the presence of armed forces in civilian facilities. We asked them to leave the hospital many times and were told that they were given the order to destroy it during retreat.
In Lugansk, servicemen showed tanks and heavy weapons left by Ukrainian militants in the liberated cities and towns. All captured grenade launchers and ammunition, armored personnel carriers, tanks and grenade launchers are productions of the UK, US, Turkey and NATO countries. Donbas leaders and citizens emphasize that the ongoing military operation of Russia was only a response to the criminal acts of Kyiv against Donbas as a timely and preemptive measure. Today, Moscow says it has documents with proof that Kyiv was preparing a large-scale attack and intended to destroy the DNR and LNR.
Russia says its aim over the past months has been to target Ukrainian military infrastructure to prevent the enemy from regrouping and reinforcing its presence in the Donbas. It says it will press ahead with a strategy until the whole region is liberated. Marina Kartunova, Lugansk region.
The Iranian flag was hoisted high in Tehran on a day that's remembered as a milestone in Iran's history. April 1, 1979 was the day when the Islamic Republic replaced 3 millennia of monarchy in Iran. This came in a referendum held months after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution that overthrew the former Pahlavi regime. The ballots contained yes or no to the Islamic Republic, and more than 98% of the eligible voters chose to vote yes.
April 1st is the Islamic Republic Day. It was a day when the monarchy gave way to democracy. We as Iranians honor this major occasion and celebrate it every year.
The Islamic Republic blessed Iran with independence and self-reliance. Today, Iran has its own industry and economy, which are not reliant on foreign countries.
The event also invited ambassadors to Iran, who took part to congratulate Iranians on the occasion.
We have a very long history of relationship with Iran, 119 years. Next year, we will be celebrating 120 years of diplomatic relations between our countries. So our relations have always been very good, sometimes closer, sometimes not so close. But in the last years, we have had very good relations. Trade relations, political relations.
Led by Imam Khomeini, the Islamic Revolution was driven by anti-imperialist sentiments, since former Iranian monarch Mohammad Reza Pahlavi was believed to be heavily dependent on Western powers, especially the U.S. Iranian officials say independence is one of the accomplishments brought about by the Islamic Republic in Iran.
43 years have passed since the establishment of the Islamic Republic, and ill-wishers are trying to deal a blow to the establishment, but because we are an independent country in every sense of the world, enemies have not been able to harm our nation using sanctions and pressures.
Since its establishment, the Islamic Republic has faced many challenges, from the Western-funded Iraqi war to the stringent sanctions imposed against the country by the U.S. and Europe. Authorities of the Islamic Republic say the establishment has reached maturity in its fourth decade of life and will not surrender to Western pressures.
The Islamic Republic revolutionized everything in Iran, even its flag, which used to bear the lion and sun emblem as a symbol of monarchy, and later was replaced by God's name, Allah, in the center, a reflection of the Iranians' Islamic beliefs, which they say were not addressed during the Shah era. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, and you are now listening to the program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend and esteemed guest speaker, Sheikh Murtada Karimi, from the Islamic Seminary of Qom. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh.
A pleasure.
Our question today is a very important question because it deals with one of the very fundamentals of Islam, as we believe that Islam is based on two things, the Thaqalain, the Quran, and the household of the Prophet. Mm-hmm. So this question is about one of these two heavy weights, these two weighty things, and that is the Quran. We as Muslims believe that one of the miracles of the Qur'an and of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him and his family, is that the Qur'an is immune to change, to alteration, to corruption. We believe that the same Qur'an that was revealed to the Prophet 1,400 years ago is the same Qur'an that we have today, and it will stay this way for all eternity. So the question is then, why, with this miracle that we believe in is that is present, why are there differences in the recitation of the Quran? Isn't this proof of it being altered by human hands and thus corrupted? And does this not open the door for the alteration and rewriting of the Quran?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. To be honest, this is one of the very difficult questions to be answered. Of course, there is some typical answers given to this question, but I'm trying to mention maybe some new ones. Of course, I'm taking benefit from some of the contemporary scholars to hopefully give a convincing answer to this very important question. Before that, we need to know about what these differences of recitations is all about. And why do we have this, what we call it, ikhtilaf al-qira'a, to begin with? Now, just to give a short history of it, from the late 2nd century and the early 3rd century after Hijrah, we have a kind of movement among some Muslim scholars to choose the most authentic recitations of the Qur'an. Did we have different recitations? I will explain later. But before that, we had different recitations. Let me just give one example, so maybe some of the dear listeners may have an image, picture of what we're talking about. So, for example, in chapter Han, we say, أَعْضُ بِاللَّهِ مِنَ الشَّيْطَانِ الرَّجِيمِ بِسْمِ اللَّهِ الرَّحْمَنِ الرَّحِيمِ الْحَمْدُ لِلَّهِ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ الرَّحْمَنِ الرَّحِيمِ مَالِكِ يَوْمِ الدِّينِ مَالِكِ يَوْمِ الدِّينِ
Right.
So these are two different ways of reciting this verse. Malik Yawmiddin means the owner of the Day of Judgment. Malik Yawmiddin means the sovereign of the Day of Judgment. Now, let me just share with you the typical answer given to this question. Although we have two, different recitations of this verse, but both of them are correct in terms of meaning.
Right. The meaning doesn't change.
So this is, we cannot call it a kind of tahrif or distortion and alteration of the Quran. And maybe this is another miracle of the Quran, that although you may recite it in two ways or three ways, but both of them are correct and all of them are correct.
Right.
So this is one of the answers given to this question, but we need to go further. Or for example, in one verse we have يَخْدَعُونَ, some people recited يُخَادِعُونَ, and so on and so forth.
Right.
Now, the first person, so we have different recitations of the Quran, and some Muslim scholars began to choose among these recitations to come to know which one is the best one. Because when you recite a verse, you can, I mean, based on different indications and evidence, you may come to this conclusion that this recitation seems at least more authentic in terms of the meaning right. and Arabic grammar and so on and so forth. Now, the first one who began to do that, according to some scholars, was a person called Harun ibn Musa, who was born in 201 and passed away in 291 after Hijra, and also Qasim ibn Salam, who was born in 157 and passed away in 224 after Hijra. This Qasim ibn Salam, identified 25 people as the best reciters of the Quran. And he recorded the ways that they recited the Quran. And the famous Qurra Sab'a, the seven reciters of the Quran, were among them. Now, one century later, Abu Bakr bin Mujahid, who was born in 245 after Hijra, and he passed away in 324 after Hijra. He did a lot. I mean, he tried a lot to study about these different recitations of the Quran, and finally he chose seven reciters as the best reciters of the Quran by recitation. Now, here I mean not in terms of
Sound.
Yeah. I mean, when we have different ways of reciting the Quran, for example, he chose this person as seven people whose ways of recitation of the Quran or reading the Quran is the most authentic.
Right.
From that time onwards, the concept of Qurra Sab'a became famous. And also the seventh ways of recitation of the Quran. Later, some people added three other reciters. So we have another term, the ten reciters. But the first one, the seven reciters,
is the more famous,
is the
widespread one.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, the other problem, if I may call it problem, is that different people narrated from these seven reciters of the Quran. For example, we have Asim. He is one of the seven reciters of the Quran. Now, we have two, for example, narrators from this person. One of them is, for example, Hafs. That is why we have the famous recitation of
right.
Hafs from
Asim.
That's
the most common one currently.
The most common right. one. But the point is that we have other people who narrated this recitation from him with slight differences. And that is why two of the narrators were chosen. And now we have another term, which is 14 riwaya, or 14 narrations. Seven reciters. From each one of them, we have two narrators, which make up 14 narrations of the
right.
Noble Book of Quran.
Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
I think it would be interesting if I may share the names of these people, because it is also a matter of jurisprudence. Nowadays, one of the questions which is asked from the Shia scholars and also maybe Sunni scholars is that which one of these recitations are we allowed to recite in the Quran? Which is the correct
right.
one? All of these seven ways or 14 riwayah, or only one of them? The first Qari or reciter is Abdullah bin Amr Dimashqi, who passed away in 118 after Hijrah. We have two Rawi or narrators from him, Hisham ibn Amr and Ibn Dakwan. The second one is Abdullah bin Kathir al-Makki, who was born in 45 after Hijrah and passed away in 120 after Hijrah. The reason I'm mentioning the dates of the birth and demise is that they were living at the time of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt. It has a meaning for us, the Shia. So at the time of the Imams, we have these different recitations recited by different people. So from Abdullah bin Kathir, we have two narrators. One of them is Ahmed bin Muhammad al-Bazzi, and the other one is Muhammad bin Abdul Rahman. Who was born in 195 after Hijrah. The third is the famous one, Asim bin Ibn Najud, the famous Asim. It's been mentioned that he learned from Abu Abdurrahman and he learned from Imam Ali alayhi salam.
Yes, we say that this style of recitation actually goes back to the first Imam.
Imam, exactly. And maybe this is one of the main reasons that we believe in this way to be the most authentic one. Two people have narrated from him. One of them is Hafs ibn Sulaiman, who was born in 90 after Hijrah and passed away around the year 180 after Hijrah. And the second one is Shu'bah bin Hayyash. So when we say that this is the recitation of Hafs from Asim, we mean that Asim recited the Quran in a specific way and Hafs narrated that from him. The narration of Shu'bah from Asim is slightly different from that of Hafs from Asim.
Right.
The fourth one is Zabban ibn Ala Abu Amr al-Basri. He was born in 68 after Hijrah and passed away in 154 after Hijrah. Two narrators, one of them is Hafs ibn Umar and the second one is Abu Shu'aib. Fifth is Hamdat ibn Habib al-Kufi. Two narrators, Khalid ibn Khalid and Khalaf ibn Hisham. Sixth is Nafi ibn Abdul Rahman. The first narrator is Warsh. This is also famous. When we say that this is a qira'ah of Warsh from Nafi', some of the Egyptian reciters in our time, they recite the Quran in this way. And this is famous as Warsh from Nafi'. So the main reciter is Nafi' bin Abdul Rahman, who passed away in 169 after Hijrah. One of the narrators is Warsh, and the other is Qalun. And the last one is Ali ibn Hamza Kasai, who passed away in 189 after Hijrah. Still, we are talking about the time before the minor occultation of Imam Mahdi, which means the presence of the Imam of the Ahlul Bayt. Two narrators, one of them is Layth ibn Khalid, and the other one is Hafs ibn Umar. So these are the seven reciters. As I mentioned, some people believe in 10 reciters. So they add three other reciters, Khalaf ibn Hisham, with two riwaya or narrations and narrators. One of them is Ishaq ibn Ibrahim Baghdadi, and the other one is Abul Hassan Abdul Karim. The ninth one is Yaqub ibn Ishaq, two narrators, Muhammad ibn Mutawakkil, and Abul Hassan Ruh ibn Abdul Mu'min. And the last one is Yazid ibn Qa'qa, two narrators, Abul Harith Isa, and Ibn Jammaz. Now, we have these seven recitations, or rather 10 recitations. From each one of them, we have two riwayah and narrations. Right. So this is the concept of Qurra Sab'a, the seven reciters, or Qurra Ashra, the 10 reciters. And from each of them, we have two narrations. That is why we have the famous term 14 riwayah or 14 narrations. Or if we go to 10 reciters, we have 20 narrations. So this is a kind of introduction to our topic regarding the concept of Ikhtilaf al-Qira'ah and Qurra Sab'ah. Now the main question before going to the concept of Tahrif is that why do we have these differences to begin with?
Where did they come from?
Yeah, Quran was revealed in one way to the Prophet. Right. So why we have all these differences? But I think we need to deal with
that. Yes, we will answer this question inshallah next time. I thank the dear Sheikh for joining us today and for sharing with us his knowledge. And I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. Until next time, fi amanillah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban li aliyin wa وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من